You are listening to 89.5 KPOO San Francisco, and welcome to Reality Sandwich, where every Thursday at noon, we serve up a palatable taste of the truth on topics of the mind, body, community, earth, society, all six areas of the healthful living model, and you can read more about that at healthfulliving.org. My name is Martin Matthews. I'm a certified clinical and medical hypnotherapist, and most importantly, advocate for healthful living. Healthful living for you, for me, for all of us here on planet Earth. And today we're going to be speaking more about the light brown apple moth issue. Last week we talked about this on Reality Sandwich, and we just were so compelled by this issue in so many fronts that we're going to dedicate today's show to it as well. But a quick synopsis. Last week we learned the nutshell factors surrounding this issue, where the state of California seems to be colluding with a number of different parties to want to dump chemicals on all of us in order to kill a not dangerous pest that doesn't really do a lot of damage. And we've learned that it's really not going to be eradicated, can't be eradicated. It's going to cause tremendous harm to a number of people, already has. There doesn't seem to be any real rationale behind it. We're trying to get to the bottom of it all. The entire matter seems tremendously ludicrous. However, let's learn more about this so each and every one of us can really deeply comprehend what's being proposed, why it's being proposed, and what each of us can do to protect ourselves and to put things back on the right track with our collective society. We have two excellent guests on the show again with us today, and I'm going to go to my partner, Julie Matthews, who's my co-host today, who's going to tell us who's joining us.
Absolutely. We actually have more than two guests on today. We have quite a few people that are going to be talking more about this. So we have, well, in the studio, we have obviously Martin and myself and Michelle Darby again, who is a concerned mom who has taken up the cause for the Coalition to Stop the Spray in San Francisco chapter, which is CASOnline.org. And she is going to talk about what we can do, how we can get involved, how we can be empowered, what actions we can take, and all of that good stuff. So we are going to wrap up the show with giving you things you can do so you can feel empowered. So please stay with us for the entire show. And we're going to start out with Dr. Andrew Gutierrez, who is a professor in the Division of Ecosystems Science at UC Berkeley. We have Nan Wishner, who is the chair of the Integrated Pest Management Task Force, and Frank Egger, who is the former mayor of Fairfax and has done a lot in his city with pesticide-free laws and things like that. As well, we are going to hopefully have on the line with us Matthew Sluter, who is another concerned citizen such as ourselves, who is going to talk about the implication on genetics and our health and things like that in the long term. So we have a lot of wonderful people to get to today.
Excellent, Julie. So let's go to our first guest. Dr. Gutierrez should be on the line with us. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hello. I'm glad you're here today.
Thank you.
So, you know, everybody kind of has their area of expertise and what they understand in terms of the light brown apple moth. My understanding is you've done quite a bit with understanding the kind of the climate and how this bug may spread or may not spread, I guess, you know. So I would love to just maybe get a little background on what you've studied and then get kind of your perspective of what's going on with this.
Okay. First, let me tell you that I'm a professor at Berkeley, and I've been here for roughly 36 years. And I started the University of California Integrated Pest Management Program, which is a statewide program back in 1978. And I have an awful lot of research experience in this area. And my main expertise currently is developing what I call systems models to evaluate the effects of biological and physical factors, such as weather, on the performance of what we call cold-blooded species, okay, things that respond to the environment almost on an immediate basis. And so one of the things I got interested in fairly recently has been light brown apple moth. And in developing the model, we can then start evaluating how climate is going to be, or weather is going to be affecting the dynamics of this pest.
Hmm.
And one of the things that came out was that, and it should have been obvious from the very beginning because the literature is fairly rich on this pest, is that it's a species that's restricted to fairly cool areas. And so what comes out of the model is that one would expect to find it where they're finding it. And for it to be as widespread as it is, it probably has been here for quite some time. So this is consistent with what other people have also been saying.
Wow. So it sounds like based on the climate, being a cooler climate, it makes sense that areas like San Francisco and the cooler coastal Bay Area would be able to sort of support this moth and its kind of existence, and that is what we've seen. And we had Dr. Carey on last week, who was talking about the moth and, you know, that fact that it might already have been here for 30 to 50 years, and it's sort of possibly taken up establishment in the areas that it can survive best. So is that, are you finding that based on the climate, it we don't have as much concern in the areas of the Central Coast where all the farming is? Or what is the implication for the spread to the rest of the country, or this concern that they have about it being such an emergency?
Well, the USDA has done an economic analysis, and at best I would find considerable fault with the analysis, because one, the models that they're using to determine its potential spread is not very sophisticated, and it's simply not very good. I would also agree with Carey, who spent some time in my laboratory back in the late 70s, about its potential and also how long it's been here. I wouldn't say it's been 30, 40 years, but it wouldn't surprise me. Mm-hmm. And it's a moth. It's called a tortricid. And, you know, pests like that are attacked by an awful lot of generalist natural enemies, and their populations tend to be kept fairly low. And this happens in Australia, and it happens in New Zealand, and it likely happens in California. Because, I mean, where is the evidence that of the damage that this thing is causing? I mean, there just simply isn't any data available. There are no instances, and it seems to be all anecdotal. So I think that the potential threat has been greatly overblown, and some of my colleagues who are probably more reticent to, you know, express their thoughts on it also have concurred on this. And I agree also the fact that it's unlikely that they're going to eradicate this thing. I mean, using pheromones to eradicate it's preposterous.
Is that because of the way pheromones work, or just the fact that the population is already so established, or both?
Well, it's too widespread, and for eradication, you have to sort of get the last pair in the environment that are close enough to continue the population. The possibility of that happening is pretty much zero. So if we think in terms of the amount of money that they want to spend, $15 million already, right, and they've allocated another $75 million. Goodness. Connors, the Secretary of Agriculture, it would seem that those resources could be redirected to something that would be more beneficial, more of societal benefit.
Wow. Well, this has really been very, very helpful. We really appreciate you being on with us today. This has been a conversation with Dr. Andrew Gutierrez, and thank you so much.
Okay.
Take care.
Yeah, bye-bye.
All right, bye. Okay. This is so, the more we find and the more experts we talk to, the more we're hearing the same story over and over again. And I think we have on next, we should have Nan Wishner on. Nan, are you with us?
I am.
Wonderful. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So it looks like you are the chair of the Integrated Pest Management Task Force. Tell us more about what you do.
Well, that's for the city of Albany over here in the East Bay, okay. And that task force was initially formed to write an integrated pest management policy for the city in response to hue and cry over a proposal to spray some Roundup on a particular baseball field in the city, and as a result of that, we ended up drafting after many meetings until 1 in the morning at the Park and Recreation Commission, we ended up drafting a policy for the city to reduce and or eliminate chemical use on city property. So that was my very local grassroots start. And then when we found out about the light brown alpha moth in December, I was really the only person in the city who had IPM on my, you know, on my credentials. And so the mayor turned to me and said, can you find out about this? And the next thing I knew, I was at the center of the light brown alpha moth controversy.
Wow. So what's your expertise or what's your area of study? How did you get involved in all of this?
No, I got involved in all of this from, you know, growing up in the country, years of growing my own vegetables, going to college and participating it was actually a farming co-op at the college where I went to school, and I've been growing vegetables organically for my family ever since, and from that, you know, comes a sort of hands-on knowledge of integrated pest management, which emerged in the 50s and 60s as a response to the sort of initial excitement over pesticides, which were, you know, products developed as part of World War II. They weren't developed for crops originally, but an industry developed, which then wanted customers after the war was over. So I grew up, you know, both in the sort of environmental revolution of the 60s and this revolution in farming, which was supposed to feed the world by using all these chemical pesticides and fertilizers, and quickly people realized that was not going to work with the publication of books like Silent Spring. And so I've just been immersed in it, really, all my life, and I'm a citizen chair of this task force, not a city employee because of that.
Wow. So what can you tell us, just give us an overview for people that weren't listening last week, what is, we understand that they want to spray, I think, 3 to 5 times over the course of a month for 9 months during the dry season, year after year, for the next 3 to 7 years to try to eradicate this moth that a lot of people are saying doesn't really cause a problem and is impossible to eradicate to begin with. But tell us a little bit about the pesticides and the delivery system and what it is that they want to actually use.
So the pesticide, we don't actually know what pesticide they're proposing to use this year yet. They're studying 4 products, and they haven't yet disclosed which one they are choosing to use. So most of what I have to say is about the pesticide that was used last year. The state has said that the product they choose for this year will be similar in type. It may not be the exact same brand name product. And the pesticide that was used last year, and so the formulation would be similar for this coming year, has 3 components. There's the so-called active ingredient. That's active is a term used by the US EPA to indicate the chemicals in a pesticide that specifically target the pests in some way. And in this case, the active ingredient is a synthetic moth pheromone, and I'll talk more about that in a second. The other 2 ingredients are a whole cocktail of other things that are in the formula, not specifically to target the pest, and those are known in EPA language as inert ingredients. They're not inert in the dictionary sense of inert, meaning they don't do anything. They're just not there to directly target the pest, and so they merit that name. And then the 3rd ingredient, or the 3rd component, is the microscopic plastic capsules in which the pesticide is dispersed. And those capsules for last year were designed to slowly break down over a 30-day period, time-releasing the pesticide. So the synthetic moth pheromones, a pheromone is a product of a living organism that's designed to facilitate, in this case, mating or sexual attraction. So they're trying to douse the whole area with this pheromone in order to confuse the moth's mating pattern. It doesn't actually kill the moth, and that's one of the reasons that this is not an effective strategy to eradicate, because as Dr. Gutierrez said, if you want to eradicate, you got to get rid of every single one of them. And confusing mating doesn't equal 100% disruption of mating. That pheromone product has actually never been tested for human exposure. There have been short-term exposure tests of other pheromones, other moth and butterfly pheromones, but not this particular pheromone, and no long-term human exposure testing. There are a number of, then, those other, that second component, the inerts. There are a large number of those, and in the formula last year, some of those included a butylated hydroxytoluene, which we know is a carcinogen. It's associated with miscarriages and birth defects. It's a mutagen, meaning it causes cell mutations in humans. Toxic to the liver and other organs like the central nervous system. I could go on. And
wow.
There's polyvinyl alcohol, which is also a carcinogen. There are a number of products. There's one about which very little is known, but it's probably an endocrine disruptor. It belongs to a family of other chemicals that disrupt endocrine function. And if you read about pesticides in the paper, you know that has significant health impacts if that's the case. So there are lots of questions about those inerts. the state will say, well, the dose is too small. It couldn't hurt people. But, of course, we don't know. And we certainly don't know about sensitive individuals within the population.
Right, right.
And then finally, there's the microcapsule, and that's the so-called delivery system. It's plastic, and that alone should be cause for concern. The particle size, the sizes of those microcapsules are the main thing, because we don't know anything really about the health effects of these either, haven't been studied, but we do know that some portion of the formula is 10 microns or smaller, and that size is really critical, because anything 10 microns or smaller can get deep into the smallest passageways in your lungs. Once it's there, you can't expel it. Your lungs actually have no power to move it out, so it either scars your lungs, it goes into your bloodstream, or it outgasses the pesticide there in your lung tissue if it stays there. So that by itself, even if there was nothing else not good in the pesticide, is cause for alarm.
Wow. So a couple things I just wanted to comment. You know, there's been some interesting studies when you said that there are these small amounts of these inert ingredients that some people say can't be a problem. But for people out there listening, I think it was bisphenol A was one of the studies they had done on one of the just a plastic that's used in bottles and things. And they found that tiny, tiny, tiny small amounts caused a big problem. Medium amounts didn't cause that much of a problem for humans. And large amounts obviously caused another big problem. So interestingly, we found that even sometimes tiny, minute amounts of these things can cause a really big problem for health effects.
That is a great point. I mean, there are many examples of that. Consider the tiny, tiny amounts of attenuated virus that are in the vaccines that give people lifelong immunity, or the tiny, you know, parts per million and billion of prescription medications that we need to have in our bloodstream in order to actually produce a physiologic effect. So I call it the fallacy of the low dose.
Right.
You know, low dose doesn't mean safe. And in fact, sometimes low dose, particularly in this case, it will be a chronic, continuous, repeated exposure over months and years, can have a worse cumulative effect than a single large dose.
Wow. And tell me, if you can, more about this pheromone. It would seem to me that if this was some sort of a signaling or hormone type thing, that it might have an effect on our endocrine systems or hormone systems. And I was reading some of the side effects that came out in Santa Cruz, some of the reports from the people down there. And interestingly, I saw, which at first I was kind of shocked and didn't understand, these things around women in menopause or past menopause who started menstruating again and disruptions in menstruation. And I thought, that's weird. And then I thought, oh, well, maybe it's something to do with this hormone or this pheromone. Do we know anything about that aspect? Or,
you know, most likely those effects would be due to this suspected endocrine disruptor element in the formula, that other, the otoxybenzophenone that I mentioned, which is one of the inerts. You raise a really good point, which is pheromones are designed to interfere with, you know, or designed to affect the signaling in biological systems. And we have no clue how this level of intense exposure to a moth pheromone might impact humans. Moths, you know, the state will say, oh, well, moths are emitting pheromones around us all the time. Well, yes, but not in these, you know, blanketing amounts that will be surrounding us 30 days at a time.
Right.
So could that, in fact, affect people's menstrual symptoms? I think the key thing is here, we don't know the science hasn't been done. We do know there's a case of a researcher I was just reading recently who was working with gypsy moth pheromones, and there in the process was exposed. And for years afterwards, everywhere he went, gypsy moths would be attracted to him, would flutter around him.
Oh, poor God.
So it's funny, but it's horrifying.
Oh, it's terrible.
At the same time, because it means that pheromone was persisting in his system.
Oh, boy.
And we have no clue, you know, what the... It's almost like genetic GMO, right?
Right.
You know, we've inserted... I mean, it wasn't inserted in his DNA, of course, like GMOs are, but we've added, you know, a foreign pheromone substance to a human system by the exposure.
Right, that doesn't just go away after he's done in the lab.
I was shocked when I read that information,
Wow. And then going to the plastic encapsulations, firstly, my understanding of plastics is that they don't biodegrade, they photodegrade over long periods of time. So is it even true that these, quote, plastic encapsulations actually break down, or?
Well, again, we have no idea, and we don't know what they break down into, presumably smaller fragments, which are then, you know, more and more likely to get into our systems. The three routes of exposure to a toxin, to a pesticide, are oral, dermal, and by ingestion. So, in this case, if you've got plastic breaking down, two of those routes are quite available to you, through the mouth and through the nose. And, of course, kids who are playing in the dirt and not washing their hands and sticking their hands in their mouths, and animals, you know, our pets who are nosing around in the dirt and rolling in the dirt and their noses are right next to the ground, you know, are all quite susceptible to taking in whatever those breakdown products will be. And, again, like I said, this hasn't been studied. We don't know anything. The state will tell you, oh, well, it just breaks down into urea, which is a natural substance in your body. And, you know, there are two points I'd like to make about that. One is we don't have synthetic urea in our bodies. Mm. We have our own urea. And secondly, it's not just urea. That's really a lie if you're saying there's only urea, because what we've created is a polymer, is a plastic, and there are other ingredients that stick it together. All of the patents, all of the articles you read about these microcapsules talk about formaldehyde as an ingredient. Yes. That ingredient is not on the list of ingredients the state that the manufacturer of last year's pesticide released. And that's a little mystifying to me when I see that it's a standard element in the recipe for the microcapsules. And, of course, I mean, formaldehyde from its use in embalming things in your high school biology lab. It's not a product you really want as a breakdown product in the environment from these capsules. East Bay Municipal Utilities District, which has all these open reservoirs and water, you know, is concerned about the watershed where our water supply is in the East Bay here, has made a big point in their contacts with the state about the fact that we have no idea what the fate and transport are, the technical terms of these chemicals that are being sprayed, are going to be in the environment. We don't know what they break down into, how they interact with each other. The whole formula of this pesticide has never been tested, you know, let alone concerns about the specific bits of plastic. So what we don't know is so much bigger than what we do know, and it's such a great concern.
Right.
We have no idea what your photodegraded or so-called biodegraded plastics mean in the environment.
I just saw a little mini documentary online on YouTube or something about the plastics in the ocean and how when they break down, even the little diatoms ingest them, and then they go up the food chain and then they go to us, and these little things, like you said, they have this thing about the law of dilution, right? If you dilute it in this huge ocean, like, remember the little mini particles like we were talking about earlier, somehow they're going to be so diluted they're not going to be a problem. But that's not true, because the little animals and microscopic things on up start to accumulate them, and they accumulate in large amounts, and they are very harmful. So I'm really concerned about, what about just the water and the runoff into the oceans? We're going to be pouring all these plastics into the ocean, and can't be good.
There's also a question at a certain size, these microcapsules, whether intact or their breakdown bits, are going to be the same size as pollen. And so what's to prevent bees from picking them up? And what does that do? You know, bees are already in trouble. Our whole pollination system is already in trouble. What does it do to that? And, yeah, you raise it. Somebody recently, I haven't verified this myself, but somebody said ingestion of plastic in the ocean is now the leading cause of death for marine species, which is just, you know, horrifying, that there's six times more plastic than phytoplankton in the ocean or something. I'm not quoting those from personal knowledge, but I did hear that recently in a lecture.
Wow.
And I just want to ingest a quick reality sandwich moment here to clarify, because when I first heard this, I said, no, you got to be kidding me. So we're actually talking about there are going to be flying planes overhead.
At 500 feet, yes, over your house.
And spraying the stuff out that's going to include these little plastic microscopic things that are going to get caught in our lungs and have all kinds of deleterious effects about which we know nothing currently. So this is not a science fiction sort of a story. This is actually a really planned circumstance that currently has the green light and currently has the okay of our governor, currently has the okay of a lot of people pretty high up at the state level, California Department of Food and Agriculture, and other people that are supposed to be looking out for us. So if you're listening and you're disgusted, you should be, because this sounds like something really, really out of a movie, out of a really scary, freaky movie. And it's just, I want to say a number of things to you, Nan, but firstly, that I'm really inspired, number one, that you have such a history and knowledge about this, and that this issue is something that brought you into, you know, action at a political level, you know, in your own town. And we're seeing that kind of activity all over, but, you mean, to take your knowledge and to share it in the way that you do is really inspiring from a broader citizen perspective of, you know, people standing up for themselves and for what is right here. You know, we absolutely must be standing up. And this is not something like, you know, you hear of issues and, oh, it's not in your backyard. This is in everybody's backyard.
Well, let's talk about backyard. Let's talk about the ground spraying. So in order to actually get every one of these moths. There is the overhead spray, by the way, that's going to affect 7 million people. And then there is the on-the-ground task of getting them. What is that? What are they going to use for that? What does that process look like?
Let me just say quickly, the eradication zone for the moth, which is both the ground and aerial spray, encompasses counties with a population of 7 million. The counties that are slated to be sprayed, they're 5 counties, and it's not the whole county in every case. Those counties have a population of about 4.8 million. I don't think this makes it any better, really, but it's just not quite 7.
4.8 million.
So
Thank you.
Conservatively, I estimate 3 million people are going to get sprayed, just for the record.
All right. No, that's good to know.
And at the rates at which people got sick in Monterey and Santa Cruz, that means we have a minimum of 18,000 people who are going to get sick if the rates hold true. And I would expect more because people are aware and more likely to report and have a means to report this time.
Right.
But you asked about ground spraying. So there is a whole ground element to this campaign, and because the aerial spraying, as your co-host just said, is so kind of surreal and outrageous and scary, that's been so much the focus of a lot of the work. But the ground treatments are not exactly a picnic in the park either. There are a number of different strategies that are being employed, ranging from these sort of coat hanger-like objects called twist ties that are designed to emit the pheromone. They're hung in trees and designed to emit the pheromone. And you actually have to sort of cover trees with them for this to work. You need something like 1,000 of them per acre to actually be effective. And they're talking about the release of some native wasps in massive numbers. Those wasps prey on butterfly eggs as well as moth eggs, so that could have its own environmental impact. And then, as you say, there are these various other chemicals that are going to be employed either in a spray or they're calling a splat method. The splat is flinging this goo up at about 8 feet on telephone poles, and the goo is laced with an attractant for the moth and then with permethrin, which is a pyrethroid insecticide that's very toxic to honeybees and is also a carcinogen and a neurotoxin for humans. That is, it is associated with both cancer and neurological problems. And then there are these substances they want to spray, which include a product called Bacillus thuringiensis. That is approved for organic agriculture. It's a spray that's based on a naturally occurring bacteria in the soil. And that may sound somewhat innocuous, but consider that they're going to be coming onto people's private property to spray this without people's consent. And it, too, has a lot of side impacts. The spraying of this stuff is not necessarily safe. All of these things were designed for targeted, localized use in agriculture. They weren't designed to be sprayed in these large-scale ways over or in populated areas. So I think as an IPM person, integrated pest management person, what I want to say is, you know, none of those things probably sounds quite as horrifying as the aerial spraying. You can hear that there are issues with each one of them. Integrated pest management supports the healthy functioning of a natural ecosystem and aims to intervene as little as possible. And if you do intervene, you want to intervene in the simplest ways, like let's clean up the debris under the trees or plants where the apple moth is most likely to overwinter. That would be a first step, assuming we even think we have a problem, which is a whole other question.
Right.
IPM starts by asking, do you need to do anything? So to go to these methods of using these various chemicals that, by definition, are going to upset the natural balance is really not sustainable agricultural practice. One of the things about the BT spray is BT is very hard on what we call the beneficial insects, the natural predators that not only prey on the light brown apple moth, and as Dr. Gutierrez said, are probably keeping it very handily in check and have been for decades, but these are natural predators that also keep other pests in check. So the minute you start spraying something to kill something, you start upsetting a balanced ecosystem and all kinds of things can get out of whack.
Right. And that's what happened in New Zealand, right? They had this pest and they tried to eradicate it and they created worse problems. Is that...
The pest, this moth did get introduced from its native Australia to New Zealand a little over 100 years ago. And a decade or longer ago, when New Zealand was heavily using a class of pesticides we call organophosphates, you may have heard or even done shows about those because they're linked now with all kinds of human health effects.
Right, right.
When New Zealand growers were heavily using organophosphates, not particularly for the light brown apple moth, for other pests, the net result was, these are called broad-spectrum insecticides, so they kill off pretty much everything. And the net result was the beneficial insects were being killed off. And so then light brown apple moth was a problem at that time in New Zealand because of this upset balance. There were no natural predators for it. As soon as New Zealand eliminated the use of those organophosphates, those broad-spectrum insecticides, around 2001, the natural predator populations rebounded within a couple of years. Light brown apple moth is no longer a problem in New Zealand agriculture. It doesn't damage crops. It doesn't damage native plants. The only reason they worry about it is that the U.S. has this trade quarantine, and they won't let any produce shipments in if there's any evidence of, at all of the moth. But so the issue in New Zealand wasn't that they were trying to eradicate the light brown apple moth. It's that they were using pesticides in a way that I would consider irresponsible for other things that messed up the natural balance, so the apple moth was out of balance and then was in a position to cause problems in crops because there were overpopulations of it. But since those pesticides have ceased being used, the light brown apple moth does not do any damage in New Zealand.
And they've learned, I'm guessing, better ways to do more natural pest management, like you're saying?
That's right. Typically in agriculture, not in populated areas like is being talked about here, they do pheromone trapping, which is what the state has been doing here to try to determine the population of apple moth. So those are those little, they look like tiny cardboard pup tents, you know, with little pheromones in it. And then if they do find the light brown apple moth numbers in the traps, more than 30 per trap, which is, you know, here we're acting on the basis of maybe 1 to 3 moths in a trap, and we're trying to spray all, you know, this huge populated area. There, if they get 30 or more, then within an agricultural setting, they might do a targeted treatment with a product that's called an insect growth regulator. It's sort of like insect birth control. These are it's like the flea treatments that people use, those little drops that you put on the backs of your animals so that the flea reproductive process is interrupted once the flea bites the animal and gets it through your animal's bloodstream. So they use a combination of trapping and these IGRs in New Zealand. But again, the only reason they'd ever bring the IGRs out is that they can't afford to have any even single larva of an apple moth in a shipment if they want to sell it to the U.S.
Right.
Not because they're worried about the moth damaging their crop.
Sure, sure.
And by the way, Europe doesn't quarantine for the light brown apple moth. So if we do reject the shipment, the U.S., they just send it off to Europe.
Right. Wow. Well, this has been really great. I really appreciate all of your expertise and time that you spent with us on the show today.
You are most welcome. Thanks for having me.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye. All right. We are going to go to a quick conversation with Matthew Sluter, and then we're going to get to Frank Egger, which should be a really exciting conversation. So do we have Matt on the line?
I'm right here, Julie.
Hi, Matt.
Hi there.
Wow. So we have so many things, and our day is so packed, but I wanted to talk a little bit because, you know, for those who know, I wrote a book about autism, and I talk a little bit about the effects of nutrition as well as toxins on our overall genes and biochemical systems and things. And you were telling me about this in terms of this current issue that we have coming up, and I thought, ooh, this hits close to home of what I find really fascinating. So tell us, you know, in addition to the toxins being unknown and most likely very problematic for humans, as well as the plastics and all the other things that are going on, but talk to us not only in terms of this particular toxin right now, but the potential effects on our genetics for generations to come.
Okay. Well, what you're highlighting there is the role of epigenetics, which is it's a field of study that has been developing lately, which looks at how there can be changes in our cell makeup that are not caused by changes in our DNA. And essentially what that means is that you can have something like either nutrients or toxins that will influence the network that precedes our genome and informs our genes. You can have changes there that will not show up for many generations to come, such as perhaps your great-grandmother was exposed to a certain toxin and, you know, that did not have an effect or a perceived effect until perhaps you or even your child is birthed. And so that's where we see that very small changes can have an effect down the road, and often it's an unpredictable effect.
It's interesting because in my book I talk about a particular study that was done on grandmothers that smoke versus mothers that smoke. And interestingly, there were more health implications on grandmothers that smoked with mothers that didn't rather than mothers that smoked directly, which leads exactly to your point that you're making, which is that we don't know the health effects of generations of these exposures, and what we do know is not looking good for the, you know, generation and generation down the line of how these toxins can affect people.
Right. I think the general thing is that the nature of our, not only our genes, but our, you know, our epigenome, of all of this organism of ourselves, that it's entirely fluid and dynamic. And the more that we learn about the genome and all of the operation of our body, the more complex and dynamic we learn that it is. And we learn that all of it is really intimately related to all of the factors which inform this whole process. And those factors really are nutrients and toxins, mm-hmm. and also the emotional environment. So
right.
It's always that we do have a bit of control in the biochemicals that we produce in our brain to affect the expression of all of this.
Sure.
So small little chemicals may have a scrambling effect on that fluid process that is beyond our ability to predict.
Right, right. Wow. Well, you're basically just like Martin and I and Michelle, right? A concerned citizen that's learning and studying this information both for yourself and I think also with some of the studying that you're doing in other parts of your life. Is that accurate?
Very much so. I am earning my Master of Science in Holistic Nutrition, and also I'm one of the co-founders of the Sustainable Health Institute.
Great.
At sustainablehealthinstitute.org. And aside from that, I've just kept myself very involved in various activism work around citizen empowerment and health as it relates to social justice.
Wow, wow. Well, we thank you so much for being on and sharing this additional area, which is so important that we really need to be thinking about and just understanding about how the genetics aren't just a fixed code or sequence, but we actually react to our environment with the ability to turn on and turn off genes more rapidly to be able to adjust to rapid changes in our environment. So I really appreciate you taking the time, you know, searching us out and telling us about this important area. So thank you so much.
My pleasure, Julie.
All right, take care.
Thank you, Matthew. So now we've learned that not only will this moth situation toxify all of us in our current lifetimes, but that we'll be altering potentially the human species going forward as a result of this action.
Well, that is a big potential, and the scary thing is that just like all the rest of the areas of this, we don't know enough to know how much effect it's going to have, and just that's not a reasonable way to proceed, in my opinion. So
right.
We should have Frank Egger on, and he is the former mayor of Fairfax and the author of I don't exactly know the name of it, but some sort of a pesticide-free ordinance in the state of the city of Fairfax when you were mayor. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Fairfax has a pesticide-free zone on all of the commons. So the town's streets, roads, sidewalks, parks, ball fields, playgrounds, open space areas, creeks, no pesticides are allowed to be used by anyone.
Hmm.
It's a complete ban. Then we have what's called a neighbor notification law. And that is where a person on their private property uses pesticides. They have to post their property, advise their neighbors or anyone passing by what's going to be sprayed, when it's going to be sprayed, and they have to give their neighbors within 150 feet around, 8 hours in advance, a written notice as to what they're going to spray, time, place, date, etc. And that's that the state, of course, the Department of Pesticide Regulation came after us in Fairfax, threatened to sue us, but they never actually sued us. The state did back off. So that part of the law, both parts of the law are in full force in effect. Yes, Fairfax is the first city. There's 478 cities in California, so we're the first one to do that.
Wow, that's amazing. So what's been your experience? It seems like you've had a lot of exposure and interest and work in this area of this new spray of the light brown apple moth, and I'm kind of curious what you've what's been transpiring lately.
Well, I'm a board member for Pesticide Free Zone Campaign in Marin County, and we have a hotline. And back in November of 2007, like it was November 2nd, I had a call from a Santa Cruz resident said that they're spraying us down here with pesticides. I said, "Oh, they're not spraying residential areas. You must be mistaken." She said, "No." So I investigated. I came down to Santa Cruz and found out that, in fact, the whole San Francisco Bay Area was in line for this aerial pesticide spraying after the first of the year. And that's when I came back to the Bay Area and started organizing and getting folks on board with a no-spray program.
Wow.
I've been involved in the anti-pesticide movement for about 10 years. I've been down to Salinas and Watsonville and over in Kern County, and we work to reduce or eliminate where we can pesticide use on farmlands and in urban areas. So I've got a pretty good background in the political side of dealing with pesticides.
Hmm.
Frank, do you have a sense of who is it who's bringing this forward? I mean, like right now, I would obviously love to speak to who is it that would sit here and champion this and say, this needs to happen.
It's
bringing this forward.
It's a great idea, right?
Yeah, it's a great idea. We should do it. Who is that?
Well, it's the program of the California Department of Food and Agriculture. And they're getting their marching orders from the United States Department of Ag. And actually, NAFTA is driving some of this. So, in effect, our trade agreements, NAFTA, the so-called fair, the free trade. Yeah, there's no such thing as a free trade agreement, but the government likes to tout the so-called free trade agreement. It's helping drive this whole insane program.
Hmm.
The CDFA, of course, works with the agribusinesses in the valley, and the agribusinesses in the valley are clamoring for this pesticide to be used. They see it an opportunity for them to have the state take care of a problem that they don't have to pay for. They don't have to buy products to use because the state's going to come in and do it for them.
Hmm.
The problem is the state's not just doing it down in their agricultural areas. Right? They're in urban areas like San Francisco and Oakland,
mm-hmm.
and in Sausalito. I mean, that's totally insane. So somehow that program got a little crazy. I'm not sure who's to blame for it, but the state has to be in a state of shock with the outrage that's come about as a result of their so-called pheromone program. It's not a pheromone at all. It's a synthetic pheromone. It's a toxic chemical cocktail. That's what they want to use in this.
Hmm. Do we know the motivation behind this? Is it financial? Is it about the trade? Is it about not having our exported agriculture?
That's what they claim. The claim is damaged. I just came from the courtroom in Monterey, and the judge took it under advisement there. In the Santa Cruz case a few weeks ago, the judge ruled that morning, heard the arguments and ruled that morning, and the case was over. In Monterey this morning, the judge had all the trial documents before him, and then each side argued the case, and the judge took it under advisement, did not make a decision. So there were quite a few of us in the courtroom, and we kind of left the courtroom, went outside, and just stood around and chatted for a bit about what do you think the judge is up to. This judge in Monterey County is cautious, but just from the questions he was asking, I think he's going to rule in a very similar fashion that the judge in Santa Cruz ruled.
So for those of us who aren't legally savvy, what does it mean to be taken under advisement? Is it stalled? What are they doing right now?
No. What it means is instead of issuing a ruling from the bench right then and there this morning, he advised both the attorney for Hope and the attorney for the deputy attorney general that was there that he would take it under advisement and issue a ruling at a later date. That could be late this afternoon, it could be tomorrow, or next week, or next month.
Hmm.
The judge has that, you know, that kind of authority and leeway to make that decision, and maybe he wants to study a little before it comes forth, this decision. But, well, you know, one of the, he was asking some very pointed questions of the Deputy Attorney General who was defending this CDFA this morning. And he said, for instance, has there been any empirical info come out of your last year's spray down in Monterey and Santa Cruz? What did you learn? And the Deputy Attorney General said, Your Honor, I don't have any information on that. And the judge looked a little bewildered. You know, I mean, this is 6 months ago they sprayed because they said they had to spray, eradicate this moth because it was going to destroy crops. And now the attorney representing the California Department of Food and Ag is in court telling the judge that she doesn't know whether or not there was any results because she doesn't have that information.
Huh.
I believe if they had the information, if they thought that they had accomplished something with aerial pesticide spraying that occurred in Monterey, Santa Cruz County, they'd have been telling the judge, it was very successful.
Right.
And this is why we have to do it in the hearing.
Right.
They couldn't do that. They couldn't make that statement. They couldn't tell the judge that.
Huh.
So, Frank, what sort of a ruling are we looking for from a judge here? I mean, are we hoping that he's going to say, no, state, you can't do this in my county? I mean, is that kind of a ruling that could be done?
Oh, okay. Both the Santa Cruz case and the Monterey case are very narrow. They're CEQA, the California Environmental Quality Act, issues. And in Santa Cruz, the judge ruled there that since there was no emergency, the state did not prove there was an emergency, if they, no emergency, and no crop damage, that they had to comply with the California Environmental Quality Act and have an environmental impact report prepared prior to spraying, not after.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully the judge in Monterey is going to rule the same way. It's going to say to the CDFA, there's no evidence of damage. There's no evidence this was an emergency. And you need to prepare an environmental impact report prior to your spraying. So what that would mean is for Santa Cruz and Monterey, in Monterey counties, no spraying until the EIR is complete. Now, what's interesting also is the judge asked the Attorney General when she expected this environmental impact report to be completed. She announced they were, you know, in the process of preparing it, and she said January of 2009. So evidently the state thinks it's going to complete the EIR process by 2009, have an approved environmental impact report. I think that's pretty optimistic. I don't believe they could do that.
Hmm. So right now we're fighting to have the proper laws upheld, the proper procedure
that's all.
Checking the safety of these things.
That's all. Mm-hmm. Folks, Santa Cruz County and Hope down in Monterey, they're just saying, just follow the law. Department of Food and Ag, follow the law. That's all they're asking.
Mm-hmm.
So I say these are narrow cases. If, in fact, the judge in Monterey rules the same as the judges in Santa Cruz, and the Santa Cruz ruling isn't final yet. It's not final yet. So, you know, it's gonna drag out a little more. But if these two cases, judges both rule that CDFA needed an environmental impact report for spraying, the CDFA has a choice, has an interesting decision to make here. You know, they've been saying we're going to immediately take it up into the 6th District Appellate Court in San Jose, and we're going to demand immediate ruling by the court because we have to be able to spray. It's a double-edged sword. They can take it up to the 6th District, these two cases, and the 6th District Appellate Court in San Jose upholds the Santa Cruz and the Monterey judges, should the Monterey judge rule the same as Santa Cruz. If the 6th District upholds them, all of a sudden, instead of just covering a prohibition on spraying until EIR for two counties, it's all 58 counties in California here. As long as they publish that opinion, basically it'll be precedent setting, and the CDFA, instead of losing just in two counties, they will have lost in all 58 counties.
Hmm.
So they've got a double sword here when they talk about they're going to appeal. The results for them could be far much worse than the two cases they lose.
Right. Wow.
Well, Frank, we appreciate your hard work, and we're going to continue doing what we can here in the court of public opinion.
I was in Sonoma last night. The city of Sonoma, city council voted 4-1. They approved a no-spray resolution. So the city of Sonoma became the first city in Sonoma County to come on board with the no-spray resolution. And we're going to Sebastopol in 2 weeks, so
great.
We're looking good, I'll tell you.
Oh, great.
It makes total sense. You know, if we could be a civilized enough society to ban secondhand smoking, you know, we certainly should be able to have ordinances that prevent people from spraying toxins, right across the side from your fence.
Absolutely.
So good for you for pushing that through, and we hope it can become statewide, and everybody should understand this.
Thank you.
Excellent. Julie and Martin, thank you very much.
Thanks. Take care.
I'll be in San Francisco at 7 o'clock tonight for the town hall meeting.
We'll
see you then.
All right.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. All right. Well, that brings us to our last few minutes here, where we're going to let Michelle Darby. By the way, welcome today, Michelle.
Thank you.
And we just want to firstly thank you for all of your hard work that you have done to help us organize these last two programs.
No problem.
So, you know, we've been hearing all of this. I think most people are pretty convinced that this is a ridiculous, harmful, and ineffective strategy. And so I'm sure there's a lot of people listening that want to be able to know what they can do. So there's a few things coming up, including the meeting this evening. So maybe you can tell us some.
That's right. Tonight, there's going to be a town hall meeting at the County Fair Building in the Hall of Flowers in Golden Gate Park, right at the entrance at 9th Avenue in Lincoln. It's going to be at 7 o'clock. It's free. A lot of the experts that you've had on the last 2 weeks are going to be speaking there. Dr. Carey, Nan Wishner, Frank Egger. There's also going to be Jeff Rosendale, who co-authored in a report with Dr. Harder. There's going to be quite a few experts speaking to this. There's also going to be tables set up for people to sign up to volunteer and get more involved and more active should they choose to do that.
Excellent.
And that's 7 o'clock tonight.
Mm-hmm.
There's also on Saturday in Corte Madera a region-wide, a Bay Area-wide Moms March to Stop the Spray. It's going to be really exciting.
That's great.
Everyone's
don't mess
meeting
with the moms.
That's right.
Right.
It's going to. People are meeting at 9:30 a.m. at the Town Center parking lot in Corte Madera, and at 10 o'clock they're going to march to Town Park in Corte Madera and have a rally. It'll be over by noon. Everyone is advised to bring umbrellas to symbolize protecting ourselves from spray.
Sounds good.
So those are two events that are coming up right away, and I'd encourage anyone who has any interest to go to both of those. Other things that can be done, I'm from California Alliance to Stop the Spray. There are plenty of groups in the Bay Area. There's Stop the Spray Marin. There's Stop the Spray East Bay. You can Google any of them. Our website is CASSonline, CASSonline.org. You can email us and volunteer that way, or you can call our phone line, which is 415-333-1977. We need all the help we can get. We're trying to get more and more information out to all the neighborhoods. It's surprising how many people don't know this is coming down the pikes in the city.
Right. Wow.
So we need to make sure to hit all the pockets of population here so that everyone at least feels like they can say something should they choose to.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a couple more things that can be done. I would encourage anyone who wants to voice their opinion to the governor to call the governor. I can give you that phone number right now.
Sure.
That's 916-445-2841. Give him a call and tell him you do not want to be sprayed.
Absolutely.
I would also encourage one more act, maybe contacting Nancy Pelosi's office and making your voice heard there on a federal level as
Great. Well, we are out of time. We have had a packed show today. You are listening to Reality Sandwich. I wanted to just one more time thank you so much for being with us, Michelle.
Thank you. Thanks.
You can catch this show at realitysandwichradio.com. We've been speaking about the light brown apple moth issue. You can get this show and last week's show. Share it with your friends. Learn all about this. This issue is in your backyard. And, you know, we all know that we can't control insects. Come on, they're going to survive the Holocaust.
They're going to survive all of us.
It's absolutely ridiculous of us to be trying to mess with Mother Nature in this way.
Right.
Everybody should be up in arms and remember that all change, including this change, and stopping this issue, begins with your efforts.
Come to realitysandwichradio.com to get more information on how to get a copy of this show, and hopefully we'll see you tonight. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Reality Sandwich on 89.5 KPOO, San Francisco. This show and any past shows of Reality Sandwich are available for free download at realitysandwichradio.com, where you can also read about upcoming shows. To learn more about Julie Matthews or Martin Matthews, go to healthfulliving.org. Thanks for listening.